So again, in this session, we're going to start with this glance meditation of the Heart Sutra. So again, I'll be slowly reading through the Heart Sutra, stopping in a few places, giving a little bit of extra commentary so that you can reflect on the meaning of the words, particularly based on what we've covered so far today. With a nice, comfortable posture, allow your awareness to descend into your body. Becoming aware of sensations throughout the body. And using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. And allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. With each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen. Without dwelling in the past, without anticipating the future, simply allow the mind to come to rest in the present moment through focusing on sensations of the breath throughout the body. the heart of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. Arya Bhagavati Prajna Paramita Hridaya Sutra. Thus did I hear at one time. The Bhagavan was dwelling on Massive Vultures Mountain in Rajgir, together with a great community of monks and a great community of bodhisattvas. At that time, the Bhagavan was absorbed in the concentration on the categories of phenomena called profound perception. Also at that time, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara looked upon the very practice of the profound perfection of wisdom and beheld those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. Then, through the power of Buddha, the Venerable Shariputra said this to the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara: "How should any son of the lineage train who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom?" He said that, and the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara said this to the Venerable Sharadvatriputra: "Shariputra, any son of the lineage or daughter of the lineage who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom should look upon it like this. Correctly and repeatedly beholding those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature." Or in other words, subsequent to logical investigation, to come to behold or see in a correct way that not just the person, but the basis of the person, the body and the mind, or the five aggregates, are also empty of inherent nature. Form is empty. Empty of what? Empty of inherent existence. Things are empty of inherent existence. They do not exist independently. Nothing is findable amongst the bases. Nothing exists from its own side. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't exist at all. Because emptiness is form. Meaning, because things are empty of independent existence, they can appear and function. Because they are dependent arisings. Depending on causes and conditions, parts and labeling. Things are merely labeled. And emptiness and dependent arising are not two different contradictory things, because they are like two sides of a single coin, because emptiness is not other than form, form is also not other than emptiness. Because things are empty, they can appear and function. And because things appear and function, they must be empty of independent existence. In the same way, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciousness are empty. So not just the body is empty of independent existence, but so too is the mind empty of independent, inherent existence. Shariputra, likewise, all phenomena are emptiness, without characteristic, unproduced, unceased, stainless, not without stain, not deficient, not fulfilled. Shariputra, therefore, in emptiness, there is no form, no feeling, no discrimination, no compositional factors, no consciousness. No eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. No visual form, no sound, no odor, no taste, no object of touch, and no phenomenon. There is no I element and so on, up to and including no mind element and no mental consciousness element. There is no ignorance, no extinction of ignorance, and so on, up to and including no aging and death and no extinction of aging and death. Similarly, there is no suffering, origination, cessation, and path. There is no exalted wisdom, no attainment, and also no non-attainment. Shariputra, therefore, because there is no attainment, Bodhisattvas rely on and dwell in the perfection of wisdom. The mind without obscuration and without fear. Having completely passed beyond error, they reach the end point of nirvana. All the Buddhas who dwell in the three times also manifestly completely awaken to unsurpassable, perfect, complete enlightenment in reliance upon the perfection of wisdom. Therefore, the mantra of the perfection of wisdom, the mantra of great knowledge, the unsurpassed mantra, the mantra equal to the unequaled, the mantra that thoroughly pacifies all suffering, should be known as truth, since it is not false. The mantra of the perfection of wisdom is declared. Tayata, Om, Gate, Gate, Paragate, Parasamgate, Bodhi, Svaha. Shariputra, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva should train in the profound perfection of wisdom like that. Then the Bhagavan arose from that concentration and commended the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Aryalokiteshvara, saying, well said, son of the lineage, it is like that, it is like that. One should practice the profound perfection of wisdom, just as you have indicated. Even the Tathagatas rejoice. The Bhagavan having thus spoken, the Venerable Sharadvatriputra, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Aryavalokiteshvara, those surrounding in their entirety, along with the world of gods, humans, asuras, and gandharvas, were overjoyed and highly praised that spoken by the Bhagavan. And then release all appearances and simply allow the mind to come to rest. Simply resting in awareness itself. Open and spacious. Not taking anything to mind. Simply resting in pristine, pure awareness. So currently we're looking at the section in the Heart Sutra, the extensive answer to how to practice this wisdom of emptiness on those first two stages of the path. And we're looking at that in terms of form or the body. And that comes first in the five aggregates because it's something physical. It's something a little bit more easy to investigate than the mind. So hence we have form here first. And what we can see from this is that form is empty. We come to realize that form, the body, or we could say the physical world as a whole, is empty of independent inherent existence. We come to realize this. But through realizing this, we're not coming to thereby understand that the form doesn't really exist, because we will also realize that emptiness is form. That, in fact, because things are empty of inherent existence, therefore form or things or the body can appear, can arise and function. We will come to realize that these things are dependent arisings, dependent on causes and conditions, parts and labeling. And not only that, we will come to understand that emptiness and dependent arising, or the two truths, conventional truth and ultimate truth, are not somehow two separate different realities, but they are two aspects of the one reality. They are two sides of a single coin. Hence the statement, emptiness is not other than form, form is also not other than emptiness. And so at this stage of the path, we really come to realize that these two things are completely complementary, two sides of a single coin. Or poetically, we can say, emptiness is fullness, fullness is emptiness. And then in the next sentence, it says, in the same way, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors and consciousness are empty. Remember, these are the four other aggregates, which collectively is the mind. So what we can do, of course, in this statement is replace each one of those as we did with form. So the first one is, feeling is empty, emptiness is feeling. Emptiness is not other than feeling, feeling is also not other than emptiness. And so we have those same four statements with each one of those four. Feeling, discrimination, compositional factors and consciousness. Which collectively, of course, means simply the mind is empty, emptiness is the mind. Emptiness is not other than the mind, mind is also not other than emptiness. So this is the answer for the first two stages of the path. And remember again that in our practice, we first look at the person, then the body and the mind. And we will come to realize that not just the person, but the body and the mind are also empty of independent inherent existence. That the body, the mind and the person are all dependent arisings, depending on causes and conditions, parts and labeling. So this is the answer, the first part of the answer. And so now we're going to look at the next part of the answer, which the outline says presentation of the mode of training on the path of seeing. But before I begin that, is there any questions left over from this last section?
What are the compositional factors?
So remember when we looked at the five aggregates, the five aggregates can be either a presentation of all functional things or can be presentation of the basis of the person. So here I think it's more related to the basis of the person, meaning that the first aggregate, the form aggregate, is the body, And then, of course, the other part of the person is the mind. And remember we said there are many ways you can divide up the mind. Here in the five aggregates, we're dividing the mind initially into two, what's called the main mind and then all of these mental factors. And when we do that, within all of those mental factors, which include, of course, all negative states of mind such as anger and jealousy, but virtuous states of mind as well, in those mental factors includes mindfulness, intention, and many other mental factors. But two of the most important mental factors were this feeling and discrimination, that they are where we often go wrong. So they're pulled out of that mental factor list and made separately. So we have them as the second and third. So compositional factors is all the other mental factors left over. And then, of course, the fifth one, consciousness, is the main mind part of the mind. Any other questions? Yeah.
Because you were saying that the emptiness is something that as well as we were reading all of the sutra, I was thinking about there is no death. So why is Buddhism?
There is no death. Oh, you mean further on?
So because, and then so why is the Buddhism so dealing with that and always thinking about, you know, from what I read, always like, you know, there you should think about that, always, you know, perfect and death meditations and so on and so on. So how is this? I'm a bit confused.
Yeah, okay. Of course, we haven't come to that section. We're going to be looking at that tomorrow. But all that list of know this, know this, know this, we have to understand what that means. It doesn't mean they don't exist. Because right at the beginning of that section, it says, in emptiness, there are none of these. And as we're going to see tomorrow, what that means is there is no inherently existent form. There is no inherently existent this. There is no inherently existing death. Which means there is death, but death is also not some independently existent thing. But that's going to come tomorrow. That's coming tomorrow, so maybe we can leave it till then. Because I'm going to talk a lot about that part of that section, actually.
I'm a bit confused about the difference between mind and consciousness. Is mind containing consciousness or consciousness part of the mind?
And this is really the challenge when we start talking about the mind, is what terms to use. And even in Sanskrit, there are a number of different terms which often are used interchangeably and sometimes not. It depends really if we're speaking very generally or we're speaking very specifically. In a general way, then mind equals consciousness. But then sometimes, particularly this word consciousness, is used more specifically,
like in the
five aggregates. So the word consciousness in the five aggregates is talking about a particular part of the mind, what's called the main mind. So that's why we have to be a little bit careful when we see these words and see the context. So yes, in general talking, mind and consciousness same. But in the five aggregates, the word consciousness is talking about what's called the main mind, only part of the mind. So that's, yes, it can be confusing.
In the text in the Heart Sutra, when it says consciousness is empty, it's part of the mind.
In that, what we've just read?
Yes,
the word consciousness here is referring to the main mind, the part of the mind that simply apprehends the entity of the object.
So that it doesn't say that mind is empty.
Well, these four together
are the mind.
Yes. So yes, it does imply the mind is empty. And of course, later in the next section, it does say the mind is empty. Of course. Depends how, I mean, of course the mind is a vast topic and we can look at the mind from many different angles, so it depends a little bit. If you want to look related like to the five aggregates, you know, the mind and mental functions, mental factors, that way of looking at the mind, then that comes from a system of teachings in Tibetan Buddhism called Lo Rig, Minds and Awarenesses. And a good book there is called Mind and Its Functions. Mind and Its Functions. Well, nature of the mind, again, when we talk about the nature of the mind, we can talk about conventional nature and ultimate nature. Ultimate nature, of course, is emptiness. You know, the ultimate nature of the mind is that it's empty of independent existence. The conventional nature of the mind is often defined as clear and knowing or clarity and awareness. So it depends a little bit what you're talking about. But, of course, particularly within the Nyingma and Kagyu schools of Tibetan Buddhism, when they approach this Vipassana practice, they really emphasize a lot focusing on the mind. So often in there, they talk about nature of the mind practice. So if that's what you're referring to, then you can draw on a lot of the literature from the Kagyu and the Nyingma school within the Mahamudra and Dzogchen. They really put a lot of emphasis on focusing on the mind in terms of coming to realize ultimate reality. So they're the books on sort of Mahamudra and Dzogchen.
Can you say something about what consciousness is dependent on?
Again, consciousness is dependent on, in the same way, causes and conditions, parts and labeling. So causes and conditions, again, substantial cause and cooperative conditions. So the mind that of this present moment, the substantial cause of that, of course, is the mind of a moment ago. And then all the cooperative conditions that affected how that mind transformed. And, of course, some of those cooperative conditions could be external things. Like we could have a moment ago, we could have a very peaceful, calm mind, and then up pops a very annoying person. And so that acted as a cooperative condition for our calm mind to transform into a mind of irritation. But the substantial cause of the irritating mind is not that person, but the mind of a moment ago. That was a contributing condition, a cooperative condition for that mind to arise. And of course, we can talk about parts, but of course, physical objects have spatial parts. Mind has temporal parts in terms of moments of consciousness. And of course the mind is also something merely labeled on that basis of the moments as well. So in that way it's the same. Cause and conditions, parts and labeling.
So if you keep going back in time and go to the beginning of time.
Beginning of time. From a Buddhist perspective, there is no beginning. And I think even according to physics, there is no beginning. See, the thing is, in classical physics, there's this fundamental principle of conservation of mass energy. And so, yes, one of the most best followed theories about the origins of the universe is the Big Bang. But I don't think an average physicist would say that the Big Bang implies that the universe comes from nothing, because that would violate fundamental principle of physics. So physics was always also find it difficult to posit an initial point where something comes from nothing. That would contradict their fundamental principles. So the whole idea of beginning is also a little bit tricky in physics.
So beginning as well as
Yeah, I mean, and again, we have to understand time in this way that we've been looking, you know, that time is also not some independent objective thing. I mean, even physics has proven there's no fixed objective linear time. You know, you can bend time, you can do all sorts of things. So also time is, you know, merely labeled. Like, for example, you know, we can talk about past, present, future. But of that, the only thing that exists is present. Because past has ceased to exist and future is yet to come. So the only thing that exists is present. But how long is the present? you know.
Yeah.
This is the trick, yeah? I mean, how long is the present? Let's say the present moment, and we magnify it. In the present moment, that's, of course, there's three parts, beginning, middle, and end. The beginning's finished. The end is yet to come. You only have the middle. But then you can divide that into three, and you can keep going down, 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 down. Can you actually point to the present? It's not findable, but it exists. And like everything, it's a dependent arising. Present is something that exists relative to past and future. But there is no findable present moment. There is no findable present.
Other than the theory that there is no beginning of time, then prove that mind is empty. Because,
say again, you lost me.
Right now,
well, we can use this to show that mind is empty. Because the only thing that exists is the present moment of mind. But can you point to the present moment of mind? You can use this reasoning to keep going down, 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 down. You'll never be able to point to the present moment of mind.
So the explanation you gave for why the mind is empty is because it's dependent on the previous moment mind.
Course and conditions, parts and labeling.
And then I was wondering, like, just keep going back, and then at one point, or other than the theory saying there is no beginning of time, like, I'm just very confused there.
Why is the mind empty?
Yeah, I'm really not able to, like, accept that the mind is empty based on this theory that it's dependent on the previous moment.
Well, we don't have to go to that point. We can just say that the mind is also something merely labelled on the basis, isn't it? I mean, the mind is just, we have this continuum, and mind is something labelled on that continuum, isn't it? We can't point and say that's the mind.
But the causes and condition includes another mind, which was the previous moment mind.
Yeah, but same with the cup. The cup that exists now, we have a previous, you know, a moment ago there was another cup there that caused this cup. Isn't it? Isn't it the same? I mean, the difficulty, of course, is it's not physical. That's where we find it, we can't see it. That's why somehow it gets, that's why we have it in this order. First the body, then the mind. Because the body is something physical, it's easier to work with, but then we can move to a more subtle object, apply the same reasoning and really also come to realize the mind is empty of independent existence. But again, it's, we have to approach this in this way. Okay. Let's move now on to the next part, down the bottom of that page then. So here, this section of the answer, we can relate to the path of seeing. So maybe before we look at the answer, let's briefly go back to our Mahayana path chart to see where we're at. So remember the previous part of the answer, we could relate to the first two stages of the path. Meaning on the first two stages of the path, we are still coming to realize emptiness conceptually or inferentially by investigating and coming to subsequently see that things are empty of inherent existence. So on the path of accumulation and the path of preparation here, as we do as a beginner, we approach it in this way, through this investigation. But of course the difference being on these two stages of the path, then now as a beginner, is that here we have this mind of shamatha, which means when we come to this experience of not finding, this is actually a inferential or conceptual realization of emptiness. And of course, because of stability of mind, that penetrates more deeply, has a more lasting effect than any little experience we would have now. And on the path of accumulation, we have shamatha, but then, of course, we have this stable, clear mind, and then we start to investigate whether it's a person or mind or body, depending on, it doesn't matter, whatever we're investigating. And when we investigate, that sort of disturbs the mind a little bit, disrupts a bit our shamatha. So if we do too much investigation, it's too unbalanced, so then we have to sort of switch back to shamatha to stabilize. So we have to sort of alternate a bit between the shamatha and vipassana. Because the vipassana practice, the investigation, disturbs the equilibrium of the mind a little bit. So we sort of alternate a little bit. Whereas when we deepen that practice and come to the end of the path of accumulation, we look down at number four here, at the bottom there. It says, number four, union of calm abiding and special insight observing emptiness. So, of course, calm abiding is shamatha and special insight is vipassana. So now, at the end of path accumulation, instead of our vipassana, our investigation, disturbing a little bit the shamatha, they actually become unified. Meaning that our investigation, instead of disturbing shamatha, strengthens it. And they become unified. We have this union of calm abiding and special insight. This union of shamatha and vipassana. And this is also, we see that in the shamatha chart. Remember that last diagram, the sword, which is the vipassana practice. If we look down at the bottom of number 32, it says the root of samsara is cut by the union of shamatha and vipassana observing emptiness. Which means that when we get to, that marks the entry point into the path of preparation, that our shamatha and vipassana are now unified. They support each other. Which means our realization of emptiness becomes more deep. Still conceptual, but because they're unified. So on the path of preparation, now that conceptual realization of emptiness is quite strong, meaning that it has very good ability to keep the mental afflictions subdued. We're not eliminating anything yet, but on the path of preparation, it would be very difficult in daily life for mental afflictions to come up due to the force of our realization. And if they come up, they're very weak and they last a very short time. And again, on the path of preparation, there's still, in the meditation experience of emptiness, there's still a sense of me, the meditator, realizing this thing, emptiness. So there's still this sort of apparent subject-object duality in our experience of emptiness, hence conceptual. But as we move along the path of preparation, deepening that experience, then that apparent duality that seems to be there collapses. And when it completely collapses, we enter the path of seeing. And then our realization of emptiness becomes direct instead of conceptual. And so that is what the path of seeing means. Seeing means to see emptiness directly, to realize emptiness directly. So at this point, there's no sense of me, the meditator, realizing this thing, this object, emptiness. There's just the experience of emptiness. Completely non-dualistic, non-conceptual, direct experience of emptiness. Now, because it's a direct realization of emptiness, it's strong enough to start to wipe out ignorance and mental afflictions, but not strong enough to wipe it all out. And when we have that first direct realization of emptiness, as we see by number seven, it says Arya, meaning that we become this Arya being. So remember, there are two types of practitioner, an ordinary practitioner and an Arya practitioner. The Arya practitioner is someone who has a direct realization of emptiness. And of course, if we are following the Mahayana path with bodhicitta, on the path of seeing, of course, we become an Arya bodhisattva. Now, that direct realization of emptiness is strong enough to eliminate the most superficial level of ignorance. And that is here what's called the you see here, abandon intellectually acquired afflictive obscurations, which means any mental afflictions that come through wrong intellectual understanding. In ignorance coming from wrong intellectual understanding. This is relatively easy to eliminate. And that's eliminated here on the path of seeing. And then we see these two little sort of shaded lines. And we look down the bottom, uninterrupted path, liberated path. I don't want to get too technical, but what this means is that uninterrupted path means now this realization of emptiness without interruption, we will eliminate that level of ignorance and we'll be liberated from that ignorance, which is the next path, liberated path. So it means that that realization of emptiness is now going to lead to the next moment having being liberated from that level of ignorance. So that's how we move between each of these stages, as we're going to see later. So that's a little bit the path of seeing. When we go to the next section tomorrow, path of meditation, then there's a lot more to be said on this chart, so we'll leave that till then. So I think that's probably enough for that. Is there anything on those first three parts that I've covered that's not clear? The what? Oh, we don't really need to go that deep. I mean, they're just sort of stages. If you study those paths, they have particular meanings, but they're not so much relevant here. Apart from on the path of preparation, each of those levels is sort of signifying less and less dualistic appearance in our realization. That's all. I mean, they have meanings, but they're not so important here in this discussion.
SM?
Oh, SM here means supreme mundane qualities. I can let you know what that means, because that is a sort of little bit related to what we're talking about, is as an ordinary practitioner, we're at what's called the mundane level. Whereas when we become an Arya, then it becomes like super mundane. You know, we've gone beyond a mundane level of existence because we've become an Arya. So supreme mundane qualities means, it's very simple, it means this is the highest level of qualities we have at the mundane level before we become an Arya. So it doesn't really say a great deal, actually. Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay. Now, of course, we need a stable mind for Vipassana. But, of course, when we do Vipassana, we're analysing.
Yeah.
And so when we analyse, investigate, that sort of disturbs the mind a little bit. So we should make sure that we try to analyse in a very quiet, not in an agitated way, because the more we disturb shamatha, the more we get distracted. So now, as a beginner, we have to sort of alternate a little bit. We do some shamatha to stabilize, then we do some investigation. If that investigation disturbs too much, we stop, go back to shamatha, back to vipassana, so we sort of alternate. But what it's saying here is that along the path of accumulation, just because of the nature of our stabilizing and investigation, at some point, instead of the vipassana disturbing the shamatha, it actually reinforces it and they become unified.
It's like you're doing the vipassana, but with the shamatha.
Well, what happens is that when it says the union of the two, it means that our investigation doesn't disturb shamatha, it enhances it. And then they become unified. Then we don't need to alternate anymore after that. That's what the union means.
As a beginner, and hypothetically speaking, are there any conventions or rules about someone having some type of insight or something like that about sharing or talking about teachers or sangha or something?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in general, I think it's not a good idea to be, if we have some experiences in meditation, to be wandering around boasting about them. Because firstly, then our spiritual path has been hijacked and we've become a spiritual ego, and usually they're not very nice people. And then, of course, because, see, if we're really working on emptiness, then that emptiness, if we use ego in the way I described it, self-grasping, that emptiness is cutting the ego. Of course, the ego doesn't want to die. So the ego is going, let's hijack this. And then the practice goes astray. So that's one point. Secondly, of course, even amongst fellow spiritual practitioners, you know, if someone around us is sort of boasting about how great they are, I mean, what happens is, you know, we tend to get a bit jealous, don't we? And then we start attacking them, and then it's a mess. So I think that's not good, because it just can lead to a lot of competitiveness, jealousy, and so. And then, of course, we attract a lot of obstacles, because then maybe people are attacking us, and then we don't want that. That's not going to help us. So we shouldn't do that. I mean, of course, if we're in a supportive sangha, then, you know, if we have some difficulties in our practice, we can ask for some help. But if we have some experiences, I think to boast or even to tell other people about these wonderful things, then I think that's not going to be very helpful to the other people, because it probably won't inspire them. They'll probably just get jealous, and then you'll have problems in your little community. But what's recommended, of course, is that if we have a personal teacher and we're having some either experiences or problems, and we don't know how to interpret that or to work with it, then we can go to the teacher in private and say, well, I'm having this experience. I'm not sure if this is some valid experience, or I'm just spacing out. Can you sort of help me about this? What to do with this? So that can be useful in private. But again, to walk around in public, I think this is not much recommended.
Just on that, maybe that's incorrect, but I heard that one of the precepts of not lying is actually referring to talking about insights of emptiness, or is it?
Yeah, that's as being more in terms of teaching as well, but also in terms of in the bodhisattva path, one of the precepts we try to follow, of course, is not to lie about our spiritual accomplishments. So even if it is some valid experience, I still wouldn't in public be talking about it, because it's just going to attract a lot of obstacles and problems with others. So I wouldn't recommend it. And again, usually when people are doing that, it's a sign that their ego sort of hijacked it anyway, and then they've really... Anyway, we'll leave it there, I think. there was another question someone had, yeah.
I just had another question, because you said that we're going in this way and we kind of pass the level, I'm going to say. But after that, when you die and you reborn,
okay, yeah.
Do you keep half that or you start again?
Yeah. With the path of seeing, when we become an Arya being, then it's generally said we're sort of on a one-way ticket out of samsara. So we're not going to go backwards. But I think there are some slight different assertions as to how early we can get that non-reversibility. It seems not to be fixed, but it seems like, from most of the things I've read, is that at least if when we get to path of seeing, yes, we're all on the way out.
So that means that you have crossed this one?
Yeah, when you've got to the third stage, path of seeing. But I have read also that, particularly on Mahayana path, at an earlier point, it's possible also to get to this point of being on a one way out. So it seems not to be exactly the same point for every person.
Just one question. From point number 7, you say it's the duality collapses. So that means the meditator doesn't even is aware of the fact that the meditator is seeing emptiness.
Well, there is a direct realization of emptiness. There is no sense of a separate meditator realizing emptiness. So when we are in that experience, it's when we come out of that experience we go, oh, I had a direct realization of emptiness. You know. Oh, yeah. When you come out, you know. If you have some doubt, you didn't. And if you're in the experience and you're thinking, I'm realizing emptiness directly, you're not. It's not possible. It's not possible. Not possible to have any thought at that time. Okay. So let's go back to the Heart Sutra then. And see what's being said here by Avalokiteshvara to Shariputra, and he says, Shariputra, likewise all phenomena are emptiness, without characteristic, unproduced, unceased, stainless, not without stain, not deficient, not fulfilled. So here we actually have eight statements, which, believe it or not, is called the Eightfold Profundity. Surprise, surprise, yes. And so here then we have the first statement is all phenomena are emptiness. So this is called the profundity of nature. Meaning that the nature of all phenomena is emptiness. Because previously we were looking at the person and the body and the mind, the five aggregates. And so now here it's said that, of course, when we come to a direct realization of emptiness, we realize the emptiness of all phenomena at that time. And that's what's being said here. All phenomena are emptiness. So that direct realization of emptiness, even if that came about through initially investigating me, the person, or the mind, or the body, as the initial investigation, when we come to realize emptiness directly on the basis of any object, then we realize the emptiness of all phenomena. So we don't have to individually realize every single one. So that's what's being said here. All phenomena are emptiness. So that is often called the profundity of nature, meaning we realize that the nature of all phenomena is emptiness. The second is without characteristic, and of course this is called characteristics. Which means not just all phenomena are empty of inherent existence, but the characteristics of every phenomena is also empty of inherent existence. So there's no inherently existent characteristic of any phenomena. Every single characteristic of every single phenomena is also empty of independent existence. That's what this means, without characteristic. So without characteristic, of course, doesn't mean no characteristic. It means without inherently existent characteristic. So no phenomena has inherently existent characteristics. And similarly, then the next two go together. Unproduced, unceased. And this is production and cessation, meaning no phenomena is inherently produced and no phenomena inherently ceases. Of course, as we're going to see with this and the next section, what is explicitly refuted is that things are empty, that the ultimate nature of phenomena, of all phenomena is emptiness, all characteristics lack inherent existence, there is no inherent production, no inherent cessation. So that's the explicit teaching here. Implicitly, of course, it's saying things do have a conventional nature, things do have characteristics, things are produced and things do cease. But of course, dependently. So that's sort of the implied here, and also in the next session, next section. So cessation means cessations, ceasing to exist, stopping existing. Sometimes called disintegration, or what's another word used here?
Death.
No, not death, because it's about the all phenomena. Okay. Then the next two in the list here is stainless, not without stain. So here, when it talks about stains, it's talking about the defilements in our mind, you know, these two obscurations. So it's not just talking about the subtle stains, but this stain is used to refer to any defilement in our mind, which is all the mental afflictions and ignorance, and also the seeds and all those things.
I never found a good translation to my language for the word defilement. Could you use another word?
Defilement. Contamination. In fact, that's often used, the word contamination. So the first one, stainless, is saying there are no inherently existing defilements. There are no inherently existing mental afflictions, ignorance, seeds, and the very subtle stains. None of these things inherently exist. That's what it means by stainless. Stainless means no inherently existing stains. Means none of the mental afflictions, none of the afflictive obscurations, cognitive obscurations, none of these things inherently exist. But of course, implicitly, it's saying there are, in fact, defilements. There are mental afflictions, there are afflictive obscurations, and there are cognitive obscurations. And of course they are also dependent arisings. And then it's going, the next, not without stain, is talking about freedom from defilements, meaning that there is no inherently existent freedom from the mental afflictions, that even gaining freedom from the defilements does not exist inherently. But of course, implicitly that means, yes, there is freedom from the mental afflictions. We can achieve liberation from the mental afflictions. And then the last two, not deficient, not fulfilled. Not deficient is talking about decrease and increase, meaning that decrease here, or in the text it's called not deficient, means there is no inherent decrease of negative qualities in the spiritual path. And there is no inherent increase in positive qualities. But of course implicitly it means that in the spiritual path there is a decrease in negative faults and there is an increase in the positive qualities. But those do not inherently exist. So there's no inherently existing faults that decrease, and there's no inherently existing qualities that increase. That's what decrease and increase means. Talking about faults and qualities. So on the path of seeing, when we have that direct realization of emptiness, we realize from that one experience that all phenomena are empty of inherent existence. All the characteristics of phenomena are empty of inherent existence, that there is no inherent production or cessation of any phenomena, there is no inherently existing mental afflictions and so forth in our mind, no inherently existing freedom from that, there's no inherently existing faults that decrease, there's no inherently existing qualities that increase. All of that. Seems like we realize a lot on the path. Which is good, no? Not inherently, exactly. Even emptiness does not inherently exist.
So this decrease-increase, is this like we're already already enlightened, it's just that we're ignorant of it, and so we're not gaining anything.
No, this is on the path of seeing.
Right.
So what we are realizing here is that the faults that we are eliminating do not inherently exist.
Yeah.
And the qualities that we are gaining are not inherently existent either.
Yeah. So there's no gains, no...
What? No inherent gain, no inherent loss. There is, of course, a decrease and an increase implicitly.
Yeah.
There is a decrease conventionally of faults, and these faults, of course, are dependent arisings, and the qualities are dependent arisings. Yes. So all of these explicitly refute the inherent existence of all those. Implicitly, they present these aspects of the path. We have mental afflictions, we can get freed from them, we're decreasing our faults, we're increasing our qualities, there is production and cessation of phenomena. Phenomena do have characteristics and they do have a conventional nature. So this implicit is also helping to avoid nihilism, of course. Yeah.
So the fifth is... The fifth refers to the third noble truth and the sixth to the fourth?
No. Defilements is the mental affliction. So this is, well, you could, if you wanted to, you can include the first, but it's basically the second noble truth.
The others.
Yeah, the mental afflictions here. We're talking about the mental afflictions, but also, of course, here in the Mahayana, we're talking about cognitive obscurations, which are not in the four noble truths.
So could you say that the sixth, only the sixth, refer to the third noble truth?
Well, of course, we're talking more about, we're not just talking about nirvana, we're talking about enlightenment as well. So here we're not just talking about free from the mental afflictions, we're talking about free from the subtle stains as well. So it's a little bit more than the third noble truth, because we're in the Mahayana here. But yeah, it's more or less similar. Now, these eight can be condensed into what's called the three doors of liberation. And some of you may have seen this presentation before somewhere. The three doors of liberation are emptiness, signlessness, and wishlessness. What these are is presentations of emptiness from different perspectives. The door of liberation of emptiness is from the perspective of the thing itself, meaning the entity. The signlessness is looking at emptiness. So remember in those reasonings we had? You remember in the different reasonings on emptiness. We could either look at the thing itself, or we could look at from the perspective of causes or the perspective of results. That's this. So emptiness is from the perspective of the thing itself, the entity. Signlessness is from the perspective of the cause, which means the word signless here means there's no sign of an inherently existent cause. And wishlessness is from the perspective of the effect or the result. You know, there's wish, and again I think the word wishlessness is there's no inherently existent result to wish for. So I think that's why they use the word wishlessness. So in this list of eight, then these two the nature of the object and the characteristics of the object, of course, are looking at the object itself. So this is in the door of emptiness. In terms of causes, then we see that these two are in a cause-result relationship. Production then follows cessation, defilements, freedom from defilements. So because they're paired like that, and the first one is looking at this cause, then all four of these get put in this second one. Whereas here, remember, this is talking about, in the spiritual path, the decrease of faults and the increase of qualities. So that's what we are, the result of the spiritual path, is to decrease faults and increase qualities. So that is in terms of wishlessness. So again, these three doors of liberation are not three different doors we're trying to go through, but these are three aspects of the one thing, three aspects of emptiness, of the realization of emptiness. The first one, of course, is from the perspective of looking at the thing itself. The second one is from the perspective of no inherently existing causes. And the third is no inherently existing results. And actually, His Holiness in his book here summarizes these very nicely. So I'll just read out what he says, and then we'll finish for today because we've run out of time. So it's on page 123, 123, if you have the book. He says, these eight characteristics can be grouped into three categories, each examining emptiness from a different perspective. These three perspectives are called the three doors of liberation. If we look at emptiness from the point of view of the thing itself, we see that all phenomena are empty of intrinsic nature and empty of self-defining characteristics. Seeing this is the first door of liberation, the door of emptiness. If we look at emptiness from the point of view of its cause, we see that it is unborn, unceasing, not defiled, and not undefiled. This is the second door of liberation, the door of signlessness. If we look at emptiness from the point of view of its effects, we see that there is no deficiency and no completeness. This is the third door of liberation, the door of wishlessness. These three doors are in actuality three ways of understanding the same thing, emptiness. The scriptures state that the wisdom that realizes emptiness is the one true door, the only way we can become completely free from the grasp of ignorance and the suffering it causes. So I think that is fairly straightforward. Maybe. Is there any last question about this before we finish up today? Because we've run out of time now, but any last question?
Production and the cessation is again of all phenomena.
Yeah. So remember here, we realize that all phenomena are empty of inherent existence. Not only that, but all characteristics of all phenomena. And no phenomena, or all phenomena, are not inherently produced and do not inherently cease. Yes. So this is with respect to all phenomena. Well, all functional phenomena, at least, yeah.
When you say nature, you mean essence, as opposed to mother nature.
Yeah. Nature. The word nature is often used in terms of, nature, sometimes essence. Not mother nature, no. Nature as in what is the nature of things. And again, when we talk about, there's a question over here about the nature of the mind. So in general, when we talk about the nature of things, we can talk about conventional and ultimate. So what is explicitly taught here is that the ultimate nature of all phenomena is emptiness. Implicitly, the conventional nature is taught, that things do have a conventional nature. Okay, let's stop there for today and have a break, and then Jonas will take over for the rest of today, and then I'll see you tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.